James Despacito, and this is New Books in History. Welcome, and thanks for joining us. I just finished talking to Stefan Ury about his new book, Ataturk in the Nazi Imagination. This book was released by Harvard University Press in 2014. Ehrich's book shows how the German far right and later Nazi Party looked toward Ataturk's Turkey as a model of resistance against the Western powers and punitive Versailles Treaty. In Turkey, Nazi elites saw lessons for Germany's future, from armed guerrilla warfare against the Entente to the ethnic cleansing of so-called undesirable populations, such as Armenians and Greeks. In Ataturk, Hitler and his followers saw a Turkish Führer that would lead the ailing sick man of Europe to modern statehood and national rebirth. I hope you have a chance to pick up Ataturk and the Nazi Imagination, especially if you're interested in the political discourse of Nazi Germany, or have an interest in the making of the modern Middle East. The Nazi treatment of Turkey is an intriguing exception to Orientalism. Rather than confined as eternally backward or unchanging, Turkey becomes a vision of modernity and resistance, not only to be praised, but to be emulated by Germany. It was a pleasure to talk to Stefan, and I hope you enjoy the show. Hello. Today, we will be speaking with Stefan Ehrich, author of Ataturk in the Nazi Imagination. Stefan, before we begin with the text, I want to ask you some questions. First, how did you decide to become a historian, and what brought you to the study of modern Turkey and in the Third Reich in particular?
Hi, James. Thank you for having me. I was interested in German history long before I started studying history at university. The Third Reich is always something very crucial to German history and German identity, of course. I was also very interested in the minorities in Germany, Turks in Germany. And so I went on to study as a minor Turkish studies in Berlin. And actually from there, I found out about the lack of knowledge of many of the connections between Turkey and the Third Reich, and that kind of what got me started on the topic.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting in the beginning of your book, you talk about this sort of interesting inversion of, so, you know, in contemporary Germany, the Turkish immigration has become sort of a problem of trying to immigrate and integrate them into German society, but also sort of keep a German identity that sort of has continuity. And it's interesting how in your book, you talk about a lot of those who grew up in the 1930s and 1940s had a lot of suspicion of Turks, not because they were alien, but because they saw similar traits in sort of modern Turkey and in, you know, and in Nazi Germany. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, in general, there's a certain perceived proximity that goes beyond actually what I'm discussing in my book. The German Empire, already before the First World War, was closely aligned to the Ottoman Empire. And there's this whole idea that, in contrast to other European powers, German relations with the Orient were kind of inverse to what the other countries were doing, namely what is otherwise described as Orientalism, didn't really apply when it came to Germany and the Turks. Already before the First World War, there was this tradition to actually see oneself in the Turks and kind of ascribe to the Turks all these German characteristics and qualities. But now after World War I, this took a totally different turn, and which we will be discussing today is also very much founded on the political situation after World War I. But there is a larger, bigger German tradition to this perceived proximity or parallel Turk to the German.
Yeah, one thing I thought was interesting coming from an education in sort of modern Britain and empire is that many of the things that the German, Imperial Germany saw in Ottoman Turkey were sort of the same ideas that Britain found in Greece. So it's interesting how that, you know, Germany was on the side of the Central Powers in the First World War, and they saw their ally in Turkish culture and Turkish identity, while Britain sort of had a more sort of more classical Greek focused kind of looking back to the sort of great ancient Greece. And it was an interesting parallelism, and it was interesting how much it was based in sort of contemporary politics. Like you said, that in your monograph, you talk about the striking lack of Orientalism of Germans towards Turkey. And it seems so strange to me as a historian of empire to be that way, but it's also fascinating at the same time. I think from that, we should segue into your first chapter, Turkish Lessons for Germany, the Turkish War of Independence as Weimar Media Event, 1919 to 1923. Could you talk us through this chapter a little bit? It was very interesting, especially the focus on the right-wing press in Germany, covering Ataturk against the Entente and the Greek army as a sort of guerrilla hero, nationalist. Please talk about the chapter.
I think the first thing to bear in mind, or actually to try to, is to get a feeling for the period and what kind of state people in Germany were in. They came out of the war, which until the end, the German propaganda suggested they were winning, and all of a sudden they lost, and they lost really everything. They lost the empire, the emperor. A new political system was instituted. There were revolutions to fend off. There was great confusion and depression, and especially something you could characterize as some sort of national trauma. And Germany was waiting for a very punitive peace treaty. They were sure of it from the beginning, and they felt very powerless, and they didn't feel that their new democratically elected politicians were doing a good job in representing the nation in these negotiations and also in what follows afterwards. So this is kind of a very dark, these are very dark times, especially for nationally minded Germans and newspaper commentators. And it's in this darkness that Turkey emerges as some sort of Eastern light guiding nationalists in Europe towards something better. It's especially in these days when in Paris the Treaty of Versailles is debated and then also is proposed to Germany and is accepted by Germany, that Mustafa Kemal, later called Ataturk, is first mentioned in the German newspapers. And there you have somebody defying the Entente dictate from Paris, not via political or diplomatic means, but with weapon in hand, as they always wrote. And this is the beginning of a fascination with Mustafa Kemal and his Kemalists fighting against all various armies, the Entente armies, actually for some brief time, the Ottoman army, and especially the Greek army, landing in Western Anatolia kind of as the proxies of the Entente powers. And for the nationalist German newspapers, this is in stark contrast to what they're seeing at home. You know, this powerlessness of a great nation, and the Turks, who have been fighting wars already since the Balkan Wars or since the Italian-Turkish War over Libya, the Turks, who have been in continuous warfare for a decade already, who are totally exhausted, have no resources left, and still are fighting the Entente. And as time progresses towards the Treaty of Lausanne in 1923, the Turks are even successful. And for German nationalists, this is really like something like hyper-nationalist pornography being played out in the newspapers on the front page day after day for years. And it is really what I try to get across in my book. It's really a media event, news from Turkey and from the Kemalists fighting in Anatolia against the Greeks, especially. Front page news are discussed in the same language and discourses as German politics, national politics would be discussed. And they're often integrated in these national domestic topics on a daily basis. And if you just look at the coverage, at the amount of coverage, it's unprecedented and never to be reached in the next 100 years. Even something like debates over EU membership of Turkey never reached such a quantity of front page coverage as this event in the early 1920s did.
Yeah, it is really interesting. You have some great visual culture images from some of the right wing press, and it's so apocalyptic. There's like you said, there is this sort of sense that the world is sort of ending for Germany, that they lost so quickly, so rapidly, and so completely. But in another sense, the Turks refused to give up in a certain way. And I think for the right-wing press especially, it was interesting for them to see Germany as a modern industrial nation with all these resources being sort of sucked dry by the Entente. There's this great image in your book from one of the papers with Clemenceau as a vampire kind of sucking the blood of the sort of made in Germany, this kind of sensationalist, one might say, a coverage of the event. I think it's important to note that with Turkey especially, it's interesting because of their semi-colonized status, it seems that their resistance to the Western powers is even more of an invitation for German nationalists to, rebel against the Treaty of Versailles, to have a sort of their own armed insurgency against the French and the British and the Americans. It's also interesting in your text, you talk about Turkish lessons. Can you talk about this idea of the lessons Germany can learn that they're sort of reading in the right-wing press?
So, as you said, what's taking place in Anatolia, what the Kemalists are doing, looked not only amazing and fascinating to the German nationalists, but really incredible. And this contrast between a strong German industrialized nation with great resources with the Turks, exhausted by continuous warfare. This contrast led to a lot of debates and discussion of this Turkish model, if it was a model at all. And especially the far-right papers, they discussed how such Turkish lessons could be applied to Germany and what these lessons could be. And it's very interesting that especially a Nazi paper, the Heimatland, took a leading role in this discussion of the Turkish lessons. And they had one German who had served actually with the Kemalists, the only foreigner serving with the Kemalist forces, who wrote a large expose, many articles on the Turkish role model. And he crystallized three major lessons out of the whole thing for Germany. One was an organization of the army as one of volunteers. The second one was the cleansing of the country of the minorities, here referring obviously not only to the Armenian genocide and also the expulsion of Greeks in Anatolia, but also implicitly referencing what German nationalists perceived to be their own minority problem, the Jewish question. And the third lesson was a strong leader figure, which at this time wasn't necessarily immediately Hitler himself, but it was important that a leader was to be found that united all the German nationalist forces, and that then in the struggle for German independence, this leader would be unquestionably followed by Germany. So these, the minorities and the leader, the role of a leader, of a national leader, these are very important Turkish lessons as the Nazis and the nationalists discussed them.
Yeah. In this chapter, you talk about the idea that is crystallizing in the early 20s in the far right of this this dichotomy between active politics and passive politics. Passive politics being negotiation, cooperation, mutual security, and active politics being this sort of dictatorial, authoritarian, direct action, sort of guerrilla fighter, militia lessons that are sort of learned from the Turkish insurgency against the Etan. I think this might be a good place to talk about your second chapter, Ankara in Munich, because you were saying that this idea of the sort of Führer principle, the leader principle, comes out of Turkey. But in this chapter, you also talk about how Munich is chosen like Ankara as being sort of the heartland of German nationalism or of Turkish nationalism, far from the cosmopolitan areas of Constantinople or Berlin.
Yeah, there's a whole set of operative political oppositions that these discourses construct. You mentioned active-passive. For others, it's this idea, is it democracy, the rule of the many, or is it the rule of the one? They're talking about that only men, strong men, make history, and that democracy is simply not able to achieve any greatness for a nation or even any feasible solutions. And on the other hand, it's this opposition between Ankara and Constantinople transferred back to Germany, Munich and Berlin. Munich was naturally already in these years a focal point of nationalism, German nationalism, in opposition to Berlin. And there were great expectations, not only from the nationalists in Munich, but also from the Bavarian state and the Bavarian army to take a leading role in this, in freeing Germany. And Mustafa Kemal, what he did, what is so special about this concept of Ankara, is that with his nationalist forces far away from Constantinople, he set up an alternative seat of government, basically, and started organizing a new country, even though there was still the old seat of government, but which, of course, in their view, was corrupted and under the boot of the Entente powers. And German nationalists construed a similar situation for Germany. And so the Hitler putsch, the beer cellar putsch of late 1923 can also be viewed in this Ankara perspective. It was this attempt to free one part of Germany, Bavaria, and especially Munich, and to establish a quasi-oppositional government to the corrupt one in Berlin. And if you look at the proceedings and also at the trial later on, this is clearly the focus of the attempt by the Nazis in Munich in this putsch. And it's much less actually Mussolini's march on Rome than Mustafa Kemal's example actually that was being followed there, because something that the later Italian Nazi axis kind of overshadows is that the March on Rome was actually not a violent counter-coup, but Mussolini was actually invited into government. There was pressure by fascist paramilitary forces, but it wasn't a violent seizure of power. It wasn't like what the Nazis had planned for Munich. So actually, I mentioned this series of articles focusing on Turkish lessons in this Nazi paper. This was just weeks before the Hitler putsch, and actually the issues leading up to the Hitler putsch in this paper discussed directly this Ankara solution for Germany and Ankara in Munich. So I think that's a very interesting and new dimension to this early Nazi history, this import and interpretation of Turkish history for Germany.
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating that you did mention Mussolini many times, but it seems at almost every juncture, the resemblance or, as you call it, twinning of Kemalist Turkey and Nazi Germany is overshadowed. It's interesting that Italy is similar, but definitely not the foregrounded theme. Why do you think that the far right saw more of themselves in Ataturk than in Mussolini.
I lost you there. Could you please repeat the last?
Oh, I'm sorry. Why do you think that the German far right saw more resemblance in Ataturk than in Mussolini?
Well, the thing is, there's of course many phases to Nazi history and to Nazi political thought. One thing we have to remember is that the German nationalist papers in general, they had already been discussing Mustafa Kemal for a few years in depth before they started really discussing Mussolini and his fascists as well. And then, of course, also, just as was the case for Turkey, there were also debates how applicable is the Italian model to German conditions and to the German situation. And I would argue that until the failed Hitler putsch, that the German far right thought that the Turkish model was more applicable to Germany, Italy not being a loser of the First World War, for example, and different political constellations. But after the Hitler putsch failed, Mussolini's example becomes much more important because Mussolini was able basically to gain power from within the system. And after the Hitler putsch failed, the Nazis realized that they too have to adopt what they call legal tactics to gain power in Germany as well. And then, of course, as time progresses, the fascist system is installed in Italy and produces many interesting results, and it becomes more important for the Nazis. And, of course, the reality of the new Turkish Republic and of Kemalism in politics and in practice differs in many respects to what the Nazis were aspiring to, which doesn't mean that the Nazis started criticizing Turkey afterwards, not at all, actually. But I think that fascist Italy was much more useful after 1923 for the Nazis in many respects. And then, of course, you know, after the Spanish Civil War, we actually have an alignment of these two countries, actually, an alignment that Germany never achieves with Turkey, even though they try throughout the war.
Okay. Also, one of the things in this book that I thought fascinating was the Nazi elite with their sort of exchanges with Turkey. You mentioned at one point that Himmler considers early in his career to abandon Germany and go to Kemalist Turkey. Later on, you talk about other sort of exchanges, cultural exchange, visits to Constantinople, I mean, or rather Ankara by Ernst Röhm of the SA. Do you think you could talk a little bit about the Nazi elite visiting Germany or visiting Turkey and what they gathered from it and what they learned from the experience?
Well, that's actually very interesting. We don't know much about Ernst Röhm's visit. We know that he went to Rome and then to Ankara, kind of like a pilgrimage, going to his idols or role models, you know, Mussolini and Ataturk. But we actually don't know much about these visits. Similarly, Goebbels later also visits Turkey, and we don't know too much about these visits. One reason is, of course, that later on these associations with the Nazis were very uncomfortable for the Turkish leadership. And also, of course, as long as Ataturk was alive, he was very reserved when it came to the Nazis and was in many respects very critical of the Nazis and their program. So whatever fascinations the Nazis had for Turkey, the cult the Nazis established in the Third Reich around Ataturk and the New Turkey was not mirrored by Turkey itself, by Kemalism, and definitely not by Ataturk himself. So it was very much a one-sided love affair, you could say. And the book is mainly about the Nazi imagination, as the title already says. It's not really about the political realities of Turkey in the end.
I see. Yes, no, that is a good point. I think this might be a good section to move to chapter 3 and talk about Hitler's Star in Darkness, Nazi Admiration for New Turkey. Do you think you could talk about this chapter and in particular Hitler's sort of mentalities with Turkey? Up till this point, we sort of talk about Nazi discourse or far-right discourse or sort of the range of elites interested in Turkey, but there's not so much about Hitler's interest in Ataturk himself.
Yeah, Hitler at various points in his career referred directly to Ataturk as a role model. I think one of the most important instances is during the Hitler trial, where he actually connects his endeavor to take power in Germany to the discussion is about committing high treason against the German state, and he points to Ataturk's example, which justifies such extreme measures when you want to save the nation. That is very interesting, and there are many other remarks where Hitler references his own role or his own thought to Ataturk. But now coming to the Third Reich, I think it's very interesting to see how after the failed Hitler putsch, the Turkish example, the Turkish role model is something the Nazis rather keep to themselves. And Hitler actually stops talking about Ataturk in public for a while. Also because, of course, Ataturk's example is associated with violence, with perhaps civil war, with coming to power against the state illegally. But once the Nazis are in power in 1933, the discourse changes back again, and Hitler references Ataturk again as his role model. And one of the interesting events in 1933 is an interview with a Turkish newspaper, which is summarized on the front page of the Nazi newspapers, where Hitler describes Ataturk as his shining star in the darkness of the 20s. And this is indeed then in the Third Reich, and the press ministry, the propaganda ministry of Goebbels reaffirms this in the Third Reich. This is the official line of the Third Reich when it comes to Ataturk and the new Turkey, the shining star in the darkness.
This chapter is interesting as well because there's a lot of material culture aspects to it. You mentioned, you know, Shem has interesting photography of this, of Hitler's sculptor making busts of him and Ataturk, sort of, again, twinning, as you call it. Do you think that there was an interest in Turkey, not just from a political, a concrete political achievements, but kind of cultural achievements as well at this time, sort of the Turkish modernizing project being faster because it's in the Middle East rather than being in sort of Central Europe?
I think as a general perspective on these developments and these discourses, we have to remember again, the old systems are gone, you know, democracy was instituted, and now these other regimes like fascist Italy, Nazi Germany, and in their view also Kemalist Turkey, try to do something different. It's like kind of a third or a fourth way, even, because Bolshevism exists, of course, as well in these times, and is a constant companion in all political debates. Now, the Nazis are looking at the new Turkey that Ataturk is building, and they have been looking at it already for over 10 years once the Third Reich is in state begins. And what they see is this kind of fusion of nationalism and a new political system under a strong leader. And in the Nazi discourse, this exists as a total glorification of all achievements of the new Turkey. It's quite fascinating to read these newspaper articles and books from the Third Reich, where almost everything is praised, like the construction of new cities, the reinvention of the Turkish nation and national spirit, culture, all these different aspects of society. Of course, there are other aspects of modern Turkey that are simply ignored in these discourses. For example, the emancipation of women is a little bit difficult for Nazi discourse. The situation of the farmers in the nation is a little bit different too. Youth culture, there's no youth movement like in the Third Reich or in Italy. So that's something that they choose to ignore, and so on. Religion, for example, would be another topic where it is very difficult for the Nazis to openly praise what Ataturk did with in relation to Islam and political Islam, because already since the 1920s and even before, there was this tendency to twin also Islam and Catholic Christianity, a supranational institution, often in conflict with national interests, alien to the national spirit and such. And you find these things also in Nazi discourses, and sometimes you find an open praise for Ataturk's secularization and breaking the political and societal power of established religion. But this is, of course, very dangerous, and you find much more in Hitler's table talks than in the printed press, because it's almost too radical to openly praise. But it's a very interesting picture, and what emerges is a new Turkey that's vibrant, energetic, and ahead even of Germany when it comes to what they call national reconstruction. And 1933, the year Hitler comes to power, is also the 10th anniversary of the Turkish Republic. And you have newspaper articles and speeches where German politicians actually say this, that Turkey is way ahead on this new path of national reawakening, reconstruction, and that Germany now has to follow in Turkey's footsteps.
Yes, yes. No, that was really interesting, especially the idea of Islam as twin to Catholicism. You talk about how the discourses in Nazi Germany about Catholicism as being a sort of an entity that holds Europe back, and specifically Germany back. So as much as that was written, did they speak at any length about that, or as you said, did they try to avoid Islam as a entity to sort of discuss in detail?
They did discuss Islam, of course, and during World War II, it also becomes very important in the war effort and strategic alliances and such. But when it comes to Turkey and the new Turkey and Ataturk, the most important thing is secularization and breaking the power of the established churches. And in this context, public discourse, let's say, in the major newspapers is very careful not to overstate the example. But for example, in Hitler's table talks, he comments on how Mussolini and also Franco in Spain should take Ataturk's role model more seriously and should do the same with their Catholic clergy as what Ataturk allegedly did with the Muslim clergy at home. So there is this idea that some more radical solution to the church question would be in store in the future. But of course, the Nazi regime didn't live long enough to take another step in this direction.
Oftentimes in your book, and this is starting from the very beginning, where sort of problematically for far-right discourse that Ataturk courts the Soviet Union at times for assistance, but also for security. How do the Nazis sort of resolve this problem? On one side, Ataturk is at points seemingly supportive of the Soviet Union, but at the same time, Bolshevism is the anathema of Nazi ideals. How is this resolved, or is this not resolved at all?
Well, in the early 1920s, when this is a big discussion, actually, or in 1919, actually, already, this is a source for a lot of confusion in the far right press, in the nationalist press in general in Germany. Some even, at least for a few weeks, think that the Kemalists are even Bolshevists or some new kind of hybrid between nationalism and Bolshevism. But very quickly, and the Nazi papers themselves take a very firm stand on this, very quickly they say, the Turks are only using the Bolsheviks against the Western powers, against the Entente. And as time progresses, they're actually saying this is a possible solution to temporarily align oneself with the Bolsheviks against the Western powers. And then in the Third Reich, when these things, Turkish modern history, or the history of the new Turkey, of the Kemalists and their struggle, when all this is debated again and narrated again, this is an even stronger feature to kind of say what the Kemalists did is okay, and is especially okay because they, from the beginning, fended off any attempts to install communist politics or a communist party in Anatolia. And Kemalism, this new kind of Turkish nationalism, was never contaminated with communist ideas. And in this respect, when these texts discuss this temporary alliance, they actually a little bit also prepare the groundwork for the later alliance, the temporary alliance between the Nazis and the Soviet Union, of course.
Yes, I thought that was another interesting twinning eventually, because of politics as they were in the 1930s. The Nazis do have to make some sort of deal with their devil, the Soviet Union. And I think it is interesting that they both had to make that choice at a certain point. I think this would be a good time to segue into Chapter 4, the Turkish Führer, Nazi hagiography, and national education. In this chapter, you talk a lot about all the books written about Ataturk in Germany. At one point, you mentioned that aside from Turkey itself, Germany has more biographies of Ataturk than any other country at this time.
Yes, indeed. This goes back again to the early 1920s and this debate between, the rule of the many or the rule of the one, which is the model for the German nation for the future. This kind of obsession with leadership in politics, and often these descriptions of Ataturk as the national leader, they're also mirrored in discussions of other national leaders. So, one of his German biographies is published in a series where they also have books on Mussolini or on Piłsudski from Poland and other national figures. But what is interesting is that in all these Führer biographies or narratives, that Mustafa Kemal is presented as the kind of original post-war Führer, like the original of the new kind of Führer in this new age, as they all describe it. And it's very interesting that these books and also newspaper articles, especially when Ataturk dies in 1938, that they make this kind of, that they open up this genealogy kind of modern post-World War I Führers and leaders. And it's always Ataturk who is the first, and then perhaps Hitler and Mussolini following in his footsteps. But of course, these narratives, these biographies or biographical texts in the newspapers or otherwhere, they also serve a very distinct purpose. They kind of try to show the German nation that it pays off to follow the Führer without questions until the end, given that Ataturk already freed the nation beyond any doubt in the Turkish War of Independence in the early 1920s. This is kind of a Führer story which already is blessed with an happy ending that Germany and Italy too still have to attain somehow. So this makes Ataturk's story into the perfect Führer story, and this is the way he's discussed. And in this fashion, not only is he meant to prepare the German nation to follow the Führer unquestionably, it's also meant to prepare the German nation for the coming war. War is central to all these narratives of the Turkish nation and of the Turkish success and of Ataturk. And war is also presented as central for the attainment not only of freedom, of real freedom for the German people, but also for this inner kind of cleansing of the nation through war, the forged in war, and so on and so forth. So these narratives, they fulfill a whole series of functions, and they're not just echoes of earlier, adulations or earlier fanhood. And I thought it was very interesting how these narratives all, you know, try to forge Germany into this leadership following mass, you know, following Hitler into the next war that is coming for certain.
Yes, yes, I noticed that as well, how these biographies and school books and all this media coming out on Turkey is sort of laced with this narrative of sacrifice, but also obedience, which is very interesting. There's also this sort of idea that the reason why Ataturk was so successful, and this is sort of leaning into the next chapter as well, but the reason why he was so successful was that the First World War allowed Turkey to banish or exterminate or destroy its internal enemies that were sort of weakening it and allowing it to be the sick man of Europe. Oftentimes in these works on Turkey, there's this contention that the only thing that was sick about the Ottoman Empire was the sort of internal elements, the enemy within, and that the Turks themselves were a strong, brave, industrious people like the Germans. Could you talk a little bit about the sort of the role of Armenians as sort of an analog to Jews in Germany? It's a really important and fascinating part of your book.
Well, it's not only the Armenians, though. What Turkey represented for the Nazis and the far-right discourses in these years was like this double cleansing of ethnic minorities. One during World War One, in what we would describe today as a genocide of the Armenians, and then after the war, and after the War of Independence, this resettlement agreement between Turkey and Greece, which led to the expulsion of the Greeks of Western Anatolia. So the Turkey presented a whole variety of ethnic engineering policies, you could say, or tools, and they were widely discussed already at the time, of course. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the Turkish lessons that were formulated in the early 1920s for Germany focused on ethnic and national purification, as they called it. So one of the reasons it is possible for the Nazis to admire the new Turkey in all its various achievements and accomplishments is also because in the Nazi view, this new Turkey was national, purely national, and cleansed of all detrimental minorities. The Armenians are especially important because in the German discourses already going back before the Nazis and before World War One, the Armenians were often seen as parallel to the Jews of Central Europe. And German anti-Armenianism, as you could call it, was like a carbon copy of German, well, of European modern racial anti-Semitism. So discussing the purification of the new Turkey always also meant discussing the Jewish question in Germany and in Europe. So they were very intimately linked, these topics. And then that also means, of course, that the new Turkey, as it's presented in Nazi discourse, is also this vision of this post-genocidal, ethnically cleansed country that can achieve the most miraculous and great things one could imagine. But of course, this is a very distorted and one-sided discourse. Other minorities, for example, the Kurds still exist in Turkey, and there's a lot of conflict in the 1920s especially, and also later on with the Kurdish population in Turkey, which the Nazis simply ignore in their discourses. They want to portray the new Turkey as ethnically homogeneous and cleansed, and so they ignore the Kurds, for example. They also ignore the Armenians and Greeks still living in Istanbul, for example. So,
yes,
as always,
yeah,
it's a very one-sided perspective and discourse there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was sort of interesting to encounter the Kurds in this because, of course, in Nazi discourse, they're a non-entity, but in contemporary discourse on the Mideast, Kurds have been very important in the Syrian conflict, but also in Turkey in recent years. I thought that was an interesting inversion. Maybe we can talk about the idea that there is a visual aspect to this. There's this interesting part in chapter 5 where you talk about Heinrich Hoffmann's photography. He's a Hitler's photographer, and his thing was sort of high modernism, taking pictures of factories and apartment blocks and these sorts of things. And he goes to Turkey and does the same thing there. He tries to capture this embellished vision of a modern Turkey that the Nazis wanted to portray to their people. What role do you think showing Turkey as this sort of modern state played in far-right discourse at this time?
Well, we can't be entirely sure that Hoffmann himself or an assistant of his went to Turkey, but these pictures of these factories and new cities, boulevards and such, they are part of the Hoffmann collection. And this Hoffmann collection is very interesting, as some of the pictures which I reproduce in the book, they're really iconic for the new Turkey, and they're reproduced in picture books, in narrative histories of the new Turkey, in newspaper articles and such. And this, of course, is similar to all the other aspects of the Nazi discourse. It's a very focused, or you could say distorted, view of the new Turkey. Of course, it focuses on the new achievement of this new kind of ethnic, folkish, national modernity that the Nazis want to accomplish themselves and want to see and find in the new Turkey. And it ignores, of course, the lack of infrastructure in other parts of Turkey and the continuing old ways of life, architecture, and so on, and social organization. But what I thought is also interesting about these iconic pictures of the new Turkey, that most of the time there are no people in these pictures. It's just buildings, crude buildings. These are like empty spaces to project whatever, you know, the Nazis wanted to project upon them. But of course, there was this sense of shared shared cultural and societal vocabulary that also expressed itself, as you said, in sculpture, in architecture, and many other things.
Well, I think we should try to get to the last chapter and the epilogue. Second World War and the Turkish relationship. Well, after all this sort of admiring discourse, this sort of fawning over Ataturk and his legacy, ultimately Nazi Germany doesn't really make a deal with Turkey, at least to get them into the Axis. Why is that? Why doesn't this occur?
Well, there are many reasons, of course. I mean, as long as Ataturk is alive, he's not a big fan of the Nazis at all. So he's rejecting any such alliances. Ataturk is much more focused on regional peace and regional systems. I think it's in this context, we need to stress again that the book deals with the Nazi imagination. It doesn't really deal with the reality of the Turkish political system in the 1920s and 30s. And it's interesting, really, to note, I think, for example, that Ataturk himself, in a published essay on the national leader, actually interferes in the German political discourse in the Third Reich from the grave, so to speak, after he dies. One of the newspapers in Hamburg publishes an essay by Ataturk on the national leader. And here he actually contradicts what the Nazis try to make out of him. And he talks about the new leader who needs to work for peace, who needs to build alliances, and that peace is more important than anything else in serving one's own people. So as long as Ataturk is alive, the Nazis have no real chance of a deep alliance with Turkey. There is, of course, economic interdependency and economic treaties. And during World War II, these economic connections become quite important for Nazi Germany. Some decisive raw materials are imported from Turkey, just as and similar as from Franco's Spain. And beyond that, not much materializes. Atatürk's successor, İsmet İnönü, is reluctant, even at times when much of the military and many of the politicians in Ankara actually would favor an alliance with the Nazis. İnönü holds them back and achieves this kind of in-between situation for Turkey until the end of the war. One reason is, of course, that Turkey is still rebuilding itself after really a long decade of warfare and has other things than territorial expansion in its on its mind. But when the Nazis attack the Soviet Union, there is a strong pro-Nazi sentiment. And as long as Hitler is winning, there always seems to be a chance that at some point Turkey would commit itself to the Nazi side and enter on the Nazi side in the war. And there are actually some instances where the Turkish Republic is supporting the Nazis through shipment of raw materials, through rearranging troops at the Soviet border, but it never amounts to much more. The feeling of being a former ally of the Germans and being close to the Germans still exists throughout the war, but the Nazis, of course, are a very difficult partner even for a semi-friendly or semi-neutral country. And the Nazis also threaten the Turks, and even if they don't get them to be their allies, it's very important for the Nazis that at least Turkey remains neutral throughout the war. So here, Nazi discourses, dreams, imaginations meet the harsh reality of the war and a very reluctant Turkey, actually. But still, all these instances put together where Turkey actually supports the German war effort, they make Turkey seem very similar to Spain as this kind of axis neutral, who in the end is still more working more with the axis than with the other side.
Okay. Stefan, can you talk a little bit about your current research projects and what are you working on now?
Well, in the meantime, I wrote a book about Germany and the Armenians, Germany and the Armenian Genocide, which came out recently. And one of the things I want to follow up on is now one of the Ottoman leaders during World War I, Enver Pasha, who is a very interesting figure. And I would very much like to write a biography on him. He's a very, very interesting and fascinating picture and largely forgotten in the Western world. The last, connecting back to this topic now, the last biography of Enver Pasha was actually published by the German army during World War II. The last one in a Western language, that is.
Yeah. Oh, wow, that's fascinating. Why do you think that that's the case?
Well, they were fascinated with the Turks, and they did know of Enver Pasha as well, already from World War I. And Enver Pasha, later on, after World War I, after residing in Germany for a while, went to Central Asia to fight against the Bolsheviks with the Muslim populations there, kind of a jihadi resistance to a Bolshevik control in Central Asia. And when the German army thinks it's coming close to the same areas in which Enver Pasha's biography played out its last chapter, it kind of thought for some strange reason that this would be relevant to German soldiers, even though already the title says struggle and death in Turkestan. So Enver Pasha was unsuccessful, and so were the Nazis, of course, as well.
Yeah, there is an interesting mention in your book several times that Turkish expansion into Central Asia is sort of referred to as another Napoleon, but they sort of forget that Napoleon ends up taking Moscow but fails. And, you know, there is this sort of idea of oh, wow, like that their failure is an option here. And if they wanted to see failure as a possibility, they would have, but they were so distorted and so confused and so deranged that it was just not there.
Yeah, I think these are very good concluding remarks, aren't they?
Okay. Thank you, Stefan.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.